Because exile is not just geography, it is a spiritual condition, a dislocation of hope. Into that space comes this servant, a servant called, named, formed by God, speaking to a people who could barely imagine a future.
That's the Reverend Tyler Tankersley. And today, he brings you a message entitled Servants of the Secret Fire. I'm Katie Givens-Keim. Welcome to episode 4217 of Day One. Welcome to Day One, the weekly program that brings you outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Hello, friends. I'm your host, Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim, and today on Day One, we welcome Reverend Tyler Tankersley, Senior Pastor of Ardmore Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Tyler holds an MDiv from Central Baptist Theological Seminary and is completing his Doctor of Ministry in Leadership and Spiritual Formation at George Fox University. He is the author of Sessions with Ezekiel and the volume on Galatians in the Preaching the Word commentary series. Tyler Tankersley, it is lovely to have you back on Day One. Welcome.
I'm honored to be here.
So you are a return Day One preacher guest, and some may remember who you are, but just for a refresher, will you just give us a little thumbnail sketch of your vantage point of ministry?
Yeah, I am senior pastor of Ardmore Baptist Church in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So we're a church located in near the downtown of Winston. Ardmore is celebrating its centennial in 2027. And so we are beginning work on that celebration now.
Oh, exciting. I happened to spot there, Tyler, that you have an NPR mug. Is that correct?
I do.
You have, loving all our radio listeners, you are quite good, I will say, also at audio production. Have a little hint of something that, was this a part of your past before?
I think that in an alternative multiverse, I would have loved to have gone into radio journalism. I'm an NPR junkie. I love local stations. I've been disheartened, quite frankly, at sort of the way that public media has been treated in our culture, and I'm a big supporter of public media. But I spent some time in college as an intern at an NPR station and learned a lot from some amazing local journalists. I got to do a story about the building of a Habitat for Humanity house in our community, and it was a really cherished time in my life. So I love ministry, but maybe one day I'll be asked to be on All Things Considered or something.
Well, I love that. And I too, before the call to ministry, I went to undergrad sure that I wanted to do journalism because I don't know about you, but it was the telling of stories, the like getting
absolutely
in on people's lives and walking with them and then getting to tell their story to everybody else. It was like the best. It was just...
Well, the power of the spoken word as well, like to convey truth. As much as technology has advanced, there is still something about the spoken word that conveys a kind of power.
Yep. And I always love, you know, Reverend Dr. Tom Long as a senior advisor in all kinds of ways to this show. And I always love the story of how before he knew he wanted to be a preacher, he was a radio DJ in Atlanta and heard preaching on the radio, heard specifically Protestant Hour and heard Edmund Stanley. Anyway, that story, I always overtell it. But yeah, so audio is so powerful and so is preaching. How has, if you reflect back just on your preaching and the place of preaching in your ministry, has it changed since, you know, 10 years ago when you started ministry?
I think like most people in ministry, I look back on my first sermons and I think those poor people, like those poor saps who, how gracious they were to sit through some of those terrible first sermons. I think that my preaching early on was I wanted everyone to know that I was supposed to be doing this and that I was smart and that I had done my research. And so you're going to sit there and for 20 to 25 minutes, you're going to hear everything I have to say about Luke chapter 4. And it, we're going to mine that for everything. And I think that it was wise, loving, kind people who came alongside me, and they never said, we need to hear this, or we need, you know, but it was living life alongside them and learning about what they were holding within their souls, what kept them up at night, what caused them to worry and have anxiety. It was not the exegesis that I was offering, but they still at the same time needed to hear from God from the text. And so preaching for me became a way to offer words that were not about me, that were not about what I knew or what I could know, but they were truths that transcended what we were all holding. So yeah, I think I was such a terrible preacher early on.
I can't really imagine that.
But. I'm continuing to learn,
Well, yeah. Speaking of learning, Tyler, what would you say is something you've learned about God or about being Christian from your parishioners?
I have learned that God is found in everyday moments, that truly, there is a liturgy of the ordinary, and that the sacredness that brings meaning to people's lives, it is found in Christian worship, and it is found in sacred spaces. It is also found in living rooms and fire pits and kitchen tables and waiting in line to pick your kid up. You know, so
accidental run-ins at the grocery store.
For sure, for sure. So I think I have found, I have learned from people that spirituality is holistic and is about how we spend our days. I think that sometimes I hear people say things like, good preachers make good churches, and I just don't think that's true. I think good churches make good preachers. And I have been so blessed to serve alongside amazing congregations that have taught me and continue to teach me more and more about who God is.
I bet, I don't know, but I bet if asked, those congregations would say that one of the things that makes you a great preacher is your humility in being open to being taught.
Well, that's kind. I hope that's what they would say.
Some of them on some days, yes.
sure. Yeah.
When you think about the gifts or challenges unique to your generation, and I'm not necessarily saying it's different than mine. I think you're a bit younger than I am, which is increasingly true the more days that go by with Day One preachers. What would you say is unique? How would you describe your generation of preachers first? And then what are challenges and opportunities that face your generation of preachers?
Well, I would say, I truly believe, I think we're in a crisis of calling.
Crisis of calling.
I think we are facing, as Christian churches, I think we are facing a dilemma where we are continuing to look towards a pipeline of calling where, you know, a young person is called when they're in high school and they go to college, and then they go straight from college to seminary, and they go from seminary into, they do a tour of duty in youth ministry maybe, and then they eventually, you know, become a preacher, and that is just not true anymore.
Yeah.
And there are fewer and fewer and fewer people who are going into vocational ministry. And I mean, seminaries are struggling to find students.
Yep.
They're paying people to go to seminary now.
Yep.
So we have a crisis in the American church, and we need to find ways to cultivate calling. To, you know, it's a slew of things. We're cynical, mm-hmm. and we're distrustful of positions of authority, mm-hmm. Rightly so.
Yep.
However, we still have to instill within people hope in what even a dirty word like institutions, like what good they can do in the world. Mm. And what organizations need are selfless leaders who are going to guide towards the greater good, rather than try to line their own pockets or increase their own, I don't know.
Profile.
Viewing, yep. audience or profile. Yep. Yes. Yeah, exactly. So I think, gosh, this sounds so like high and lofty. And I don't mean this to sound cheesy, but I really think my generation, what we struggle with is we struggle with seeing leadership as being about virtue and character. And I think that we need to regain a sense of ministry as a pathway, as a calling, as a whole life endeavor.
Yep. I think I can, I bet you can too. If I pause right now, I could fill the silence with so many opinions on this topic from our colleagues, like so yep. many. There yep. were some who dive in here and say, well, you know what we need to think about is we need to think about tent makers. We need to think about how, you know, the professionalization of Christian ministry is not a thing that is sustainable for everyone or for all situations or for all churches all the time. Or they would talk about like, this is the forces of secularity, or these are the failures of the moderate and progressive mainline Christian denominations in America. Or this is, I mean, oh man, we could make a list, right? It's so many things. And in the midst of it, we just have to keep doing it.
Yeah. And by the way, those all can be true.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Like it's so multifaceted, and it is not limited to moderate progressives.
It sure
like,
isn't.
It is.
It sure
it
isn't.
It is a church-wide ideological spanning problem.
Yep.
I do think that we need to innovate, and there are old models that need to be reimagined. But at the same time, like, the gospel still has to be preached, and good news has to be spoken over saints who pass on, and babies need to be dedicated, and couples yeah. need to be blessed. And so in the midst of, for me, when I find myself getting hopeless or cynical, which I'm embarrassed to say happens more often than I would love for any of you all to know.
That's real.
What always seems to call me out of it is the small things.
Mm.
It's the everyday deeds of ministry. I remember during the pandemic, we had just moved to North Carolina. We didn't know anybody, and suddenly the world shut down. And I remember one day in particular feeling just absolutely bottomed out and hopeless. And I was so tired of preaching to a laptop in an empty sanctuary.
Oh, death march.
I hated it. It was killing my soul. And then Ray Freeman called, and his wife, Vicky, had just passed away. Ray was older than me by about 60 years, and he was asking me to just come and sit with him.
Oh.
And that's all it was.
Oh.
And I just went and sat with him, and we sat at his mica-topped dining room table, and he poured me a cup of weak Folgers, and we just talked about Vicky for 2 hours. And then at the end of that time, we prayed together. And in the midst of my hopelessness and in my cynicism, I remember getting back into my car and thinking, this is what I am called to do.
Now listen for God's word as we hear from the book of Isaiah, chapter 49, verses 1 through 7.
Listen to me, you islands. Hear this, you distant nations. Before I was born, the Lord called me. From my mother's womb, he has spoken my name. He made my mouth like a sharpened sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me like a polished arrow and concealed me in his quiver. He said to me, "You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will display my splendor." But I said, "I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing at all. Yet what is due me is in the Lord's hand, and my reward is with my God." And now the Lord says, "He who formed me in the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob back to him and gather Israel to himself, for I am honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has been my strength. He says, 'It is too small a thing for you to be my servant, to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light for the Gentiles, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth.' This is what the Lord says, the Redeemer and Holy One of Israel, to him who was despised and abhorred by the nation, to the servant of rulers. Kings will see you and stand up. Princes will see and bow down. Because of the Lord who is faithful, the Holy One of Israel, who has chosen you." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Now, Reverend Tyler Tankersley's sermon entitled "Servants of the Secret Fire."
A couple of years ago, there was a trend on social media where women were asking their male partners this question: "How often do you think about the Roman Empire?" Evidently, these women were surprised that their husbands or boyfriends or friends were thinking about ancient Rome way more than they thought. One day, we were at home, and my wife, Jessica, turned to me and asked, "How often do you think about the Roman Empire?" Not that often," I said. She paused and then asked, "Okay, how often do you think about Lord of the Rings?" "Every day," I immediately said. "It's true. I think about Middle Earth way more than I think about the Roman Empire. I love Lord of the Rings. That's my Roman Empire." And one of my favorite scenes is when the wizard, Gandalf the Grey, stands before the fiery, demonic Balrog on the bridge of Khazad Dûm. If you've seen the films, you know that Gandalf blocks the bridge, turns towards the monster, and declares, "You cannot pass. I am a servant of the secret fire, wielder of the flame of Arnor. Dark fire will not avail you, flame of Udûn. Go back to the shadow." Then Gandalf holds his staff high and declares, "You shall not pass." Ah, it's an amazing moment. Gandalf identifies himself here with confidence and clarity. He says, "I am a servant of the secret fire." That line came to mind as I read Isaiah 49 this week, because in our text, we meet a figure who stands before the forces of their world, not with a staff, not on a bridge, but with a calling, a servant, someone who can say, "I know who I am. I know what fire God has placed within me." This servant isn't Isaiah. Isaiah, the prophet, introduces them, but this is another voice, one who has been set apart by God for a particular purpose. The servant songs in Isaiah give us a portrait of someone God chooses, shapes, and sends. And we need to remember where these words first landed. Isaiah 49 speaks into the trauma of exile, into a community that had lost almost everything that once grounded them. Their land was gone, their temple destroyed, their leaders scattered, their identity shaken to its core. People wondered if God had abandoned them or if their story was simply over. Because exile is not just geography, it is a spiritual condition, a dislocation of hope. Into that space comes this servant, a servant called, named, formed by God, speaking to a people who could barely imagine a future. The servant's voice rises in the ruins, saying, God is not finished with us. The story is not over. Light can still break in. So is this servant figure a royal official, a prophet, a metaphor for Israel, or a symbolic representative of a faithful community? Well, scholars don't agree. And maybe that's the point. Maybe the servant here is meant to be both an individual and a community, one person and a whole people. The church has long seen Jesus reflected in these words, and rightly so. But we can also let this text speak in Isaiah's time and in ours, where God still calls and forms people to reflect the very heart of God. What does this servant teach us? What does it mean to be a servant of the secret fire, so to speak, one who carries God's light? The servant begins, "The Lord called me before I was born. While I was in my mother's womb, he named me." Before the servant does anything impressive, before they speak truth to power, before they become a light to anyone, God names them. Identity comes first. In our spiritual formation, identity always precedes activity. God calls us beloved before God calls us useful. God forms us before God sends us. But we live in a culture trained to do the opposite. We define ourselves by achievement, by performance, by productivity. This is why spiritual practices such as keeping Sabbath and contemplative silence are so important. There aren't ways to make God love us more. They are how we let God's voice rise above all the other voices, the voice of shame, the voice of fear, the voice of market productivity, the voice of comparison, the voice of urgency. Communities of faith need this grounding too. Churches who forget their identity start to chase trends or anxiously reinvent themselves. Churches who remember their identity as beloved, called, rooted in God can minister with freedom and calm. They don't rush. They don't panic. They don't measure everything in numbers. They embody God's love because they are secure in God's love. Identity comes first. Then the servant surprises us. They say in verse 4, "I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing." There's some raw honesty here. This servant is discouraged, tired, burnt out. They wonder whether their efforts have made any difference at all. Maybe you've been there. You work hard at your job or your ministry. You love your family. You volunteer. You pray and still wonder, is any of this going anywhere? And the Bible never pretends that God's people are immune from exhaustion. In fact, the Bible is often more honest about fatigue than the church is willing to be. Spiritual formation is not about becoming superhuman. It is about meeting God in our limitations. Many congregations today feel tired. Shrinking resources, aging members, cultural shifts, denominational struggles. It is tempting to believe our strength has been spent for nothing. But the servant's tiredness does not disqualify them. It becomes the very place where God speaks next. God does not say, well, come back when you're more energized. God says, you're discouraged? Good. Now listen, because I have something to show you. And here comes the turn. One of the most beautiful lines in all of Isaiah. In verse 6, God says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the survivors of Israel. I will give you as a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. Too small a thing for your calling to be limited to Israel. Too small a thing to restore only one people. Too small a thing to think your light is for a single group, a single tribe, a single nation. In other words, your mission is bigger than you think. Your light is brighter than you know. Your calling extends farther than you have imagined. That's why the church reads passages like this during Epiphany, the season of light, the season when we remember that Christ's light was never meant for one people alone, but was revealed for all nations. Epiphany pulls our gaze outward. It reminds us that the light God gives is not a private possession, but a gift meant to travel, to cross borders, to illuminate places we have not yet dared to go. Epiphany is God's gentle insistence that the world is wider than our worries and that the gospel is bigger than our boundaries. When God forms us, God always widens us. Our compassion, our welcome, our listening, our justice, our curiosity. God pushes us beyond our comfort zones and beyond the borders we prefer to draw. For us individuals, this might mean welcoming the neighbor we instinctively avoid. It may mean listening to people whose experience challenges ours. Perhaps practicing hospitality to the lonely or confronting our own prejudices. It may mean learning to see Christ in the faces we've often overlooked. And for churches, this means refusing to shrink. God says it is too small a thing to serve only our members. It is too small a thing to do ministry that protects our comfort. It is too small a thing to remain silent where justice calls us to speak. It is too small a thing to be a community for insiders, but not outsiders. It is too small a thing to ignore the needs of the poor, the lonely, the oppressed, the displaced. God invites congregations into a spirit-expanded imagination. A community whose love points outward, whose compassion crosses boundaries, whose welcome has no walls. Friends, Isaiah is trying to tell us, you carry a holy fire too. You have been called from the womb, named before you drew your first breath, shaped for a purpose that is not about you, but always, always for the healing of the world. It means we don't get to say our lives are too small to matter. We don't get to believe the lie that we have nothing to offer. We don't get to let exhaustion or cynicism have the last word. Our task is to keep the fire lit through prayer, through compassion, through acts of courage, through telling the truth, through loving the neighbor we would rather not love. We are called to the places of fracture, to stand on the bridges, to face down the shadows of our own day, and to say with humility and hope, darkness will not pass here. Because the world is aching for communities that carry light, that carry courage, that carry compassion, that carry justice, that carry joy. Sisters and brothers, you are called. You were formed for the healing of nations. You were born to shine. So may we stand where we are needed.
May we remember the fire we carry, and may we step with courage into the calling God gave us before we were born, a calling to be light, a calling to be love, a calling to be Christ's servants in a world that still waits for redemption. Amen.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Tyler Tankersley. For a free transcript of his sermon, Servants of the Secret Fire, you can visit us online at dayone.org. And to our radio listeners, thank you for tuning in. While you've heard the full sermon, there's even more to the conversation. To hear the complete interview and discussion, check out the Day One Weekly Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts, at dayone.org or on our YouTube channel. Be sure to subscribe so you won't miss a moment. Each week, we take a moment to say thank you. This gratitude moment lifts up one of you, our faithful listeners who walk this journey with us. Today, we are thanking God for James Green Ripley of Alpharetta, Georgia, who made a donation in memory of his grandfather, Reverend J.B. Green, a Columbia Seminary professor and one of our preachers from April 1946. James even helped us recover a lost sermon from our archive, and in doing so, also brought us this poem from J.B. Green about how to preach a sermon. Start low, proceed slow, rise higher, catch fire, to spirit wed form, sit down in a storm. Wow. James, thank you for helping us preserve and celebrate this beautiful piece of Day One history. Just as Reverend J.B. Green once gave his voice to the church, today's listeners, like James Green Ripley, give back in gratitude, and you can too. Every donation, whether in memory of someone or in hope for the future, helps Day One continue its work of proclaiming God's love. To support this ministry, visit dayone.org/donate or mail your contribution to Day One, 4062 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite A629, Atlanta, Georgia 30319. And thank you for being part of this beautiful circle of generosity. Next week on Day One, we welcome Reverend Dr. Amy Moiso for a timely message rooted in Paul's call for unity in the church. It so happens that we are coming right up on the annual Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, which was started back in 1908. In Amy's sermon, Transformational Foolishness, she takes us into the heart of 1 Corinthians, where Paul basically urges a divided community to stop picking teams. We all know we live in an age of deep polarization. So what is unity, and can we even do it? Amy suggests Christian unity is not sameness or avoidance of conflict, so what is it? Don't miss this thoughtful, honest, hopeful sermon for a fractured time. That's Reverend Dr. Amy Moiso next week on Day One.
Oh, Tyler, thank you for that sermon you drew from The Lord of the Rings in this sermon. What aspects of Tolkien's story speak most deeply to your faith and your pastoral calling?
Oh my gosh. I hope that this is like a 3-hour episode of Day One, because I could talk about this for a very, very long time.
Oh my gosh, you remind me of Stephen Colbert when he talks about Lord of the Rings.
Okay. No higher compliment could you give me, by the way. Thank Manway that you are making that comparison. So, I think that Tolkien's work, first of all, it's this incredibly deep rabbit hole where it is not, they are amazing movies and
for
they're
sure.
thrilling, There is also this deep mythology. I mean, what happens in The Lord of the Rings is the third age in Middle Earth. There are events in the first age and the second age that are absolutely captivating. And faith, you know, Tolkien was a very devoted Catholic, and, you know, there's some of his faith was sort of what led writers like C.S. Lewis. And so he had a very infectious faith. And at the heart of Lord of the Rings, Tolkien was once asked in an interview, what are these stories about? And he said, well, they're about what every good story is about, death. That it's about death. That it is about how do you handle your own mortality and how do you find meaning in light of your own mortality? So you can choose to hoard gold like the dragon Smaug. You can choose to be devoted to your precious like Gollum. You can choose to live a quiet life that, you know, doesn't ruffle any feathers like most of the hobbits in the Shire. Or you can choose to live for something grander, bigger, better, to serve others. You know, you can be Frodo, who takes the ring, Sam, who goes with Frodo. You can be Gandalf, who fights the Balrog and then returns as Gandalf the White. You can be Aragorn, who is not content to just be a Dunedain strider, but instead takes his rightful place as king of Gondor. Keep in mind, you asked this question.
I know,
so this
I know.
Is Bring this it, is your yeah. fault, Katie. So, and also, I love that my children, if they're watching this, their eyes are like perpetually rolled back in their heads now.
Oh, so, Dad. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, that's going back to, especially near the end of your sermon, it gets back to calling, like real true calling, that telling us that your light is brighter than you think. Our call is bigger than we know. And oh goodness, if that isn't just something so important to hear in January of 2026, just before we recorded this, in the 48 hours beforehand, my eyes passed over something. It was in a secular spirituality sort of e-newsletter somewhere, somehow, and I'm not going to remember the book, but there's a book that has recently come out that's about dimmers. Dimmers as in the things that dim our vitality. And I was just thinking like how apropos it is to think about what dims us and then what brightens us, especially in Epiphany, as you said, the season of light. And so as we think about dimmers, the things that keep us from being fully bright, what comes to mind as you think about ministry and walking alongside so many other people who are trying to find light, aren't we all?
I would say that the most pervasive myth in our culture right now is the myth of self-sufficiency.
Right.
And we have to be careful because I'm not trying to send the message that we're all just a bunch of totally depraved, absolutely horrible creatures. But I do think that we are dimmed when we buy into the myth that that light emanates from within just through our own effort and just through our own achievements and just through our own productivity. And there is a calling to see beyond just ourselves and just what we can do and just who we are.
Yep.
And I think that's where that light comes from. I love in the Nicene Creed, when it says light from light, that when it describes Christ, and the way the Orthodox Church describes that is it is uncreated light, meaning we can't make it. It is something that comes only from beyond. So I think the myth of self-sufficiency is one of those dimmers that
yes.
It is very easy to buy into.
Yes. There is. I'm glad you brought up the Orthodox Church, you know, of the three Christian traditions, Catholic, Protestant, also Orthodox Church. We actually have now all three represented on our little day one team. We didn't try to.
Oh, wonderful.
And yeah, so our director of comms, she was sharing with us earlier this month just about the traditions of Orthodox Christians around theophany, for instance. And I think we Protestants have some, it is so inspiring to put in a primary place the revelation of light, especially in dark January in the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah. Well, and this is why we as Protestants, why it's been fun to explore what it might look like to bring once in a while, like an Orthodox Christian voice to preach. So little preview of what's to come in 2026. Exciting.
That's great. Very cool.
Well, one of the dimmers I remember this other author talking about is things that are good, like exercise, mm-hmm. food, and work. And whoo, I felt seen on that one. I'm like, well, yes, if there's a, as an Enneagram 7, like if there's a pain to avoid by just working more and bigger and better, yeah. But it's a dimmer, and it can become, could we say that could become a, what would you say, Gollum's ring? No, yeah, is that right?
My precious. Yeah, also, I will see your Enneagram 7 and raise you an Enneagram 3.
Okay.
who is constantly obsessed with achievement and—
Get her done.
You know, doing more. Right.
Maxing it.
Hustling. Yeah, right. The good things of life can be dimmers as well.
Yep.
I feel like often, you know, going back to the passage from Isaiah, I wonder if sometimes our good things are just too small.
Yep. Our good things being too small. Say more about that.
Well, I think it goes back to self-sufficiency, that exercise for our bodies or for our self-image or something like that, it's fine. But what about exercise so that we are healthy to help others?
Yes.
Or, you know, I just often think that the good things in life, we often shortchange because they're meant to be tools to equip us to do the work of ministry in the world. They become dimmers when we keep them just about us.
Yes. Perfectly said. Tyler, you described exile as not just a place, but as a spiritual condition, exile. Where do you sense that exile shows up in ordinary lives here in January 2026?
There's a great book by Walter Brueggemann on the prophets that I love that's simply called Reality, Grief, Hope.
Ooh.
And it's the three tasks of a biblical prophet, like Isaiah. You have to define reality. You have to name for people, this is what is true. And especially in our world, truth is so liquid. Truth is so subjective.
Yeah.
And I do think, not to sound too much like a old-fashioned preacher, but truth is not subjective. Like, truth is truth. And I think that's part of the calling of Christian ministers is to name truth, to define reality.
Yep.
And when people experience that truth, there will often be grief. And ministers, prophets, are called to come alongside people in the midst of their grief and to help them to manage it. But you always end with hope. You always end with what new things God is doing, not outside of our grief, but through our grief, through our loss,
yep.
through exile.
Yep.
So here in Isaiah 49, this is people in the midst of Babylon, and yet out of Babylon comes this servant that God is calling to show people how do you navigate this loss and this pain.
Yep. And I love also hope is the truth. That's the truth. If yeah. And if what's that that other Christian tradition where it's like if it's not good yet, then it's not over. You know, if we're yeah. not seeing the hope yet, then we're not done. Because yeah. the truth is hope. Love and hope do win. They ultimately do.
All shall be well. All shall be well, and all manners of things shall be well.
Tyler, thank you so much for bringing us the light and the truth in this sermon today. And thank you for being back on day one. We can't wait till the next time.
I'm very honored to be here.
You've been listening to Day One, the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches for 80 years, proclaiming God's hope to a hurting and divided world. 80 years is a whole lot of Sundays, and we're grateful to God for every one. Day One is produced by the Alliance for Christian Media. You can visit us anytime at dayone.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. May the grace of God be with you on day one and every day yet to come.